Listen to the land, it has a story for you, about people and their dreams, and how they made them come true. Listen to the land, listen to the land.
The destruction of the buffalo herds and the removal of the Plains Indians to reservation opened up the vast northern plains to the cattle industry. Between 1865 and 1880, the business of cattle ranching grew to a multi-million dollar enterprise in a day when $1 million was a lot of money. But for most of us, the importance of the range cattle days comes down to one figure, the cowboy. Who can guess how many stories and movies and television programs have been made about the cowboy? But I'm afraid we still don't know too much about the cowpuncher, because what we must understand is this, that there was no single cowboy type. Like all human beings, they were individuals. No single description of what a cowboy was like will cover all the men who lived on the range. Take the matter of clothing. Most wore sombreros and high-heeled boots, but these articles of dress were dictated by the needs of the cowboy's work. Otherwise, the cowboys wore what they had and what they could buy in town. About the only thing they shared in common was the fact that their clothes were usually dirty and in pretty bad shape. Then there's the matter of spurs. We think that all cowboys wore spurs, but I've talked with old-timers who declared that not all cowboys attached spurs to their boot heels. One rancher in western Nebraska said that his cowboys had to be good enough horsemen to handle horses without spurs. We've always understood that the cowboys were deeply religious. Indeed, one of the first cowboy songs American school children learn is called The Cowboy's Prayer.
Last night as I lay on the prairie and looked at the stars in the sky, I wondered if ever a cowboy could drift to that sweet by and by. Roll on, roll on, roll on, little dogies, roll on, roll on. Road to that bright, happy region is a dim, narrow trail, so they say. But the broad one that leads to perdition is posted and blazed all the way.
But to think of every cowboy as a man who spent time thinking about spiritual matters would be wrong. Maybe some of them did, especially when they rode alone on night herd. But cowboys were like everyone else. They didn't have much time for church or religion, and in the man's world of the cow camp and around the campfire, you can bet there wasn't much talk about God. Not any more than you would have heard around the stove in a New England country store at this time. And what about guns? I've heard old-time cowboys swear they never saw a cowboy carrying a gun. One day I met the son of a man who'd been one of western Nebraska's most famous sheriffs. I asked him if his dad ever carried a gun. Not usually, he replied. When I asked why he didn't pack a gun, the son reached into a drawer and pulled out a huge .44 pistol. He led me to the backyard. "Aim at the barrel over there by the barn," he told me. I took aim and fired, and I have no idea where the bullet went. It missed the barrel and the barn. I then understood why it was often said that the safest place to be standing was where the gun was pointing. Now, this doesn't mean that some of the cowboys weren't good marksmen with a pistol, but the average cowboy had neither the time nor the desire to develop this skill. A six-shooter strapped to the hip was worn to town because it certainly made a man feel big. But old-timers have told me over and over again that few cowhands enjoyed the prospect of a shootout. We must also realize that the cow towns weren't really as bad as TV has made them out to be. Sure, they were pretty rough places when the trail hands came in, but the violence and the bloodshed have been overdone. In every cow town, there were merchants and townsmen who didn't like to see their property shot up, and these solid citizens hired the local lawman who saw to it that the cowboys stayed within reasonable limits. And when he faced a tough bunch of drunken cowboys, the sheriff usually reached for a shotgun, not a six-shooter. Like many of you, I grew up watching the Saturday matinee cowboy shows. So imagine my surprise when I heard old-time cowboys say they never heard a cowboy sing. One fellow told me that he knew of one cowboy who tried to sing, but he couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. Another declared that if a cowboy turned up at his ranch with a guitar tied to his saddle, the boys would have laughed him off the place. But others have told me that many cowboys did indeed sing while working the cattle, but they usually sang the Texas lullaby. That is, just any old tune and any old set of words that came to mind. Just something to make noise to let the cows know that the riders were there. Of course, there were some things that the cowboys shared in common. The most obvious thing was the work they performed. Cowboying was hard, exhausting, and brutal. During the roundups, which came twice a year, the men worked from dawn until sundown. Branding time meant that the men worked until they dropped from exhaustion. And then there were the hours spent riding fence lines and chasing strays through blizzards and dust storms. It was a young man's work, and it is said that any cowboy who was still able to work when he was 30 years old automatically became known as the old man.
A cowboy's life is a dreary, dreary life. Some say it's free from care. Rounding up the cattle from morning till night in the middle of the prairie so bare. Half past four, the noisy cook will roar. Hoopah, hoopah, hey. Slowly you will rise with sleepy feeling eyes. The sweet dreamy night has passed away.
The cowboy could not have functioned without his horse. Here in western Nebraska, I've heard the story of a cattleman who kept a saddled horse tied outside the back door of his ranch house at all times. He used the horse even if he was going to the barn 100 yards away. A visitor from the east asked him why he rode the horse. It'd be much quicker just to walk to the barn. The rancher snorted, looked at the dude, and snapped, "If God had meant for men to walk, he would have given us 4 feet." Without his horse, the cowboy was nothing. So the intelligent cowboys broke and trained their horses carefully. Their most valuable possessions were often their night horses. That is, the horses they rode when on night herd duty. A cowboy literally put his life in the hands of this animal. Take a look at the western rangeland. How would you like to ride at a dead gallop over this rough country at night? And yet, if the herd stampeded, this is what the cowboys had to do. And there are countless stories about the intelligence and bravery of the night horses who made it possible for the cowboys to do their jobs. No wonder the cowboy talked about his horse to anybody who could listen, and that those who could sing always sang about them.
I ride an old paint, I lead an old dam. I'm going to Montana for to throw the hula hand. They feed in the coulee, they wallow in the draw. Their hair is all matted, their backs are all raw. Ride around, little dogie, ride around them slow. For the fiery and snuffy are raring to go.
The question comes up, where did the cowboys come from? Well, it seems as though just about every segment of the male population was represented. There were a few well-to-do Easterners, there were some foreigners, and we now know that there were many, many black cowboys. Some historians believe that as many as 25% of the men who worked along the Texas trails were black cowboys. But the largest number of cowboys probably were the sons of homesteaders, the nesters, as the cowboys called them. Life on a western homestead could be pretty grim. Many boys ran away from the drudgery of the farm to become cowboys.
Oh, it's little Joe the wrangler, he'll wrangle nevermore. His days with the remuda, they are o'er. 'Twas a year ago last April he rode into our camp, just a little Texas stray and all alone. It was late in the evening when he rode up to our camp on a little Texas pony he called Chaw. With his broken shoes and overalls, a tougher looking kid you never in your life before had saw.
During the 1870s, the northern ranges rapidly filled up with cattle. Some operators made money hand over fist, but there were also problems. Sensible cattlemen saw that too many cattle were being grazed in the grass, and the range was giving out. Moreover, homesteaders were moving into the country, which previously had been totally cattle country. The homesteader had the law on his side. You must remember that during the days of the open range, the cattlemen did not own the land on which their cattle grazed. They used government land. So quite understandably, the cattlemen were disturbed when nesters moved in. In many parts of Nebraska, the cattlemen and the farmers clashed. Over in Custer County, for example, men employed by Print Olive, the largest cattleman in central Nebraska, lynched two homesteaders who dared settle on the range. In the 1880s, the era of the open range came to an end. There were too many cattle, and the market price fell to rock bottom. Then, a couple of terrible winters practically wiped out many of the herds. The cattlemen who had the guts to try to pick up the pieces realized that they now had to operate in different ways. They had to purchase expensive blooded cattle, far different from the tough old longhorn. They had to buy land and fence their pastures, and the cowboys turned to feeding cattle rather than herding them. The modern cattle ranch in western Nebraska bears only a slight resemblance to the great spreads of the open range days. There are still horses in the west, and there are still cowboys. But the cowboys now use pickup trucks and helicopters, and with real sadness in their voices, old-timers say that life on the range just ain't what it used to be. The ranchers of western Nebraska share a proud heritage, a heritage made by men who knew and loved the western prairies and sandhills. And more than that, they were unique people in that they understood the land and they lived in close alliance with it. They were people who truly listened to the land.
Beautiful Nebraska, peaceful prairie land, laced with many rivers and the hills of sand. Dark green valleys cradled in the earth, rain and sunshine bring abundant birth. Beautiful Nebraska, as you look around, you will find your rainbow reaching to the ground. All these wonders by the master's hand, beautiful Nebraska land. We are so proud of the state where we live. There is no place that has so much to give. Beautiful Nebraska, as you look around, you will find your rainbow reaching to the ground. All these wonders by the master's hand, beautiful Nebraska land, beautiful Nebraska land. Listen to the land, it has a story for you, about people and their dreams and how they made them come true. Listen to the land, listen to the land.
Western Nebraska is the stretch of country that the frontier leaped over. Back in the 1840s and 1850s, the covered wagon pioneers headed for Oregon and California. They had no interest in the Great Plains except as a highway that led them to the promised lands along the Pacific coast. They left the prairie to the Indians and the buffalo. After the Civil War, this changed. Railroads pushed west into the prairie heartland of America, and behind the railroads came the cattlemen. In this part of Nebraska, the cattlemen were first. Operating with the skill and wisdom born of men who knew the land, they proved that the prairie country was both valuable and productive. The railroad, of course, was the vital factor. Without it, there would have been no cattle industry, and the railroad also brought the filling in of the country. It was alongside the tracks that towns first appeared. End-of-track towns were famous in the West. You see, railroad construction went on for only a part of the year. Where track laying ended for the season, there, a town always mushroomed. Well, really not much of a town at first, usually just a collection of tents, shacks, and a pretty rough population. The foundations for more substantial communities were also laid. First there'd be a depot, then a couple of rough board buildings, eventually a hotel, a general store, and always a couple of saloons. Chapel followed this pattern. The town developed around a depot, which was partly dug out, partly a shack made out of railroad ties, and partly a wrecked boxcar. An early settler in Chapel purchased 3 corner lots, the best in town, for the price of $12. Obviously, there weren't people standing in line to buy town lots. During these early years, many Western towns were wide open places. Sydney is a good example. One of the most important towns in Western Nebraska, Sydney had many claims to fame. An army post stood on the eastern edge of town. The soldiers from Fort Sydney protected the railroad and policed the prairie trails. Sydney was the jumping-off place for the gold fields, which were open in the Black Hills of South Dakota during the 1870s. Thousands of prospective miners poured into Sydney on the Union Pacific, purchased their equipment, had a final fling, and headed north along the Sydney-Black Hills Gold Rush Trail. Life could not have been dull in a town where there were 23 saloons in one block, and where men got ready for a trip to the Black Hills.
Kind friends, you must pity my horrible tale. I'm an object of pity, I'm looking quite stale. I gave up my trade, selling Wright's patent pills, to go hunting gold in the dreary Black Hills. Don't go away, stay home if you can. Stay away from that city that's known as Cheyenne. For old Sitting Bull and Comanche Bill, they'll lift up your hair on the dreary Black Hills. The roundhouse at Cheyenne.
While stories about crime and violence in Western towns may have excited Eastern readers, the folks out here quickly wearied of criminal activities. A group of citizens of Sydney twice, once in 1879 and again in 1881, formed vigilante committees to clean up the town. Ringleaders of the unwanted element were told to clear out. Those who chose to ignore the warning were likely to find themselves dangling from the business end of a rope looped over the crossarm of a convenient telegraph pole. This happened several times at Sydney, and you can only imagine what train passengers from the east thought of this town when they spied a body swinging in the breeze from one of the posts along the tracks. Most of the people who came west expected to earn their living by hard work, but always there were those who sought an easier way. Near Big Springs in 1877, a group of young cowboys stopped a Union Pacific Express train and robbed it of nearly $60,000 in gold and currency. One of the ringleaders of the group was a fellow from Texas by the name of Sam Bass. There were 6 in the gang. 3 were almost immediately tracked down and killed. 2 were never heard of again. Sam made it back to Texas safely, but in less than a year, he was killed by Texas Rangers, and Sam Bass became part of the legendary West.
Sam Bass was born in Indiana. It was his native home. And at the age of 17, young Sam began to roam. Sam first came out to Texas, a cowboy for to be. A kinder-hearted feller you seldom ever see.
Some time ago, I had a visit with a wonderful pioneer woman who'd come to Western Nebraska in the late 1890s. Her father planned a homestead along one of the few rivers in the Panhandle, and the family arrived at their dugout at night, so everyone was up at dawn, excited to look over the new home. The woman said she was very surprised to see that the ground in the valley appeared to be covered with frost, but this couldn't be. It was August. So she walked into the prairie and saw that the ground was covered with buffalo bones. That's what made it appear as though it was covered with frost. For the next couple of years, she said, the bones were mighty important to her family. because they were able to pick up wagon loads of the bones and sell them in town to men who shipped them east for use in industrial processes. She thought they got $2 for a load of bones, enough to buy food for the family. And then, of course, there were the buffalo chips, which also were plentiful. Many of the first settlers got through the first winter in the West, it said, by faith, hope, and buffalo chips. Out in this country, where rainfall is very uncertain, even during good years, it seldom rains more than 14 or 15 inches in the panhandle, the farmers had a rough time. Shortly after the turn of the century, a Nebraska congressman, Moses Kincaid, persuaded Congress to adopt a homestead law which would permit settlers in northwestern Nebraska to receive 640 acres of land instead of the usual 160 acres. Kincaid argued that in this dry country, a farmer needed more land. Maybe he was right, maybe he was wrong. But anyhow, a new wave of settlement came to the West. The people who were known as Kincaiders and who were said to have sung this song.
You ask what place I like the best, the sand hills, oh, the old sand hills, the place Kincaiders make their home, and prairie chickens freely roam. In all Nebraska's wide domain, 'tis the place we long to see again. The sand hills are the very best, she is the queen of all the rest. The corn we raise is our delight, the melons too are out of sight. Potatoes grown are extra fine and can't be beat in any clime. In all Nebraska's wide domain, 'tis the place we long to see again.
Despite the optimism of the Kincaiders, farming was an uphill struggle in western Nebraska. In the early 1900s, some men talked about a new system of agriculture they called dry farming. By using special machinery and by planting special drought-resistant crops, farmers in the panhandle could expect to get a crop. But dry farming was expensive, and it required much time and effort. Big operators could use the technique with some success, but the small farmers just couldn't make ends meet. So much of this country went into gigantic wheat ranches, which produce huge crops of wheat when hailstorms and droughts stay away. I've heard people say that this last frontier was the hardest one of all. I'm inclined to believe them. There were so many frustrations and so many disappointments. People came filled with optimism only to fail. Small wonder many of them believed that they had been cheated and deceived. And when these discontented people went into politics, as they did in the 1880s and 1890s, their songs expressed their frustration.
There's a dear old homestead on Nebraska's fertile plain where I toiled my manhood strength away. All that labor now is lost to me, but it is Shylock's gain, for that dear old home he claims today. Oh, my dear prairie home, never more in years to come can I call what I made by toil my own. The railroads and banks combined their lawyers paid to find out a way to rob me of my home. Now we must pay for the chance to till the soil when God calls us over his great range. All heaven will be owned, I suppose, by men who never toil, so I doubt if we notice the exchange. Oh, my dear prairie home, never more in years to come can I call what I made by toil my own. The railroads and banks combined their lawyers paid to find out a way to rob me of my home.
And the Nebraska frontier produced great political leaders, men like George W. Norris and William Jennings Bryan, who knew what life in the West was like, and who insisted that government must be responsive to the needs of the people who inhabited the last frontier.
There's a deep and growing murmur going up through all the land from millions who are suffering beneath oppression's hand. Not charity, but justice to the working poor demand, and justice they shall have. Rally, rally, all ye voters. Rally, rally, all ye voters. Rally, rally, all ye voters. and vote for home and right. There's an army at the Capitol, a valiant band of peace, and many more are marching on, its numbers to increase. They voice the people's sentiment that evil law shall cease and equity shall reign. Rally, rally, all ye voters. Rally, rally, all ye voters. Rally, rally, all ye voters, and vote for home and right. The hirelings of the plutocrats, whose legislative might would rob the people of their homes and every free man's right, are doomed to see their sun go down in everlasting night, for they'll be voted out. Rally, rally, all ye voters. Rally, rally, all ye voters. Rally, rally, all ye voters, and vote for home and right. Rally, rally, all ye voters.
The last frontier was not really a typical frontier. Usually we think of the frontier as a place of opportunity, a place where resources waited to be developed. But in this land, devoid of water, timber, and minerals, there was no basis for rapid economic development. I suppose this is why the people of the last frontier have exhibited such toughness and strength of character. They had to have these qualities to stick it out. Along this last frontier, we see a curious mixture of old and new. Towns in this region are often just infants, many of them less than 50 years old. You can visit with men and women who came to this country in covered wagons and who lived in sod houses and remember when herds of longhorn cattle roamed the valley. And yet today we see the installations which hold Minutemen missiles spotted over the country. And although we also see cowboys herding cattle, the romantic world is not quite the same. The realities of the modern world are not far away. If we but listen, what great stories the land can tell us. And if we look around, the story of the land becomes even more vivid, for there is real beauty in this country, the beauty of a land that will never be completely tamed, a land of pioneers and of unfulfilled dreams, the wonderful story of a people and their land.
Beautiful Nebraska, peaceful prairie land, laced with many rivers and the hills of sand. Dark green valleys cradled in the earth. Rain and sunshine bring abundant birth. Beautiful Nebraska, as you look around, you will find your rainbow reaching to the ground. All these wonders by the master's hand. Beautiful Nebraska land, we are so proud of the state where